Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
It a little bit harkens back to the kind of rural old times where you help your neighbor out. You know, your tractor's broke down. Well, I can borrow your piece of equipment. You know, I've had that happen at my farm before.
That's Megan Hutchison of the local Growers Guild. She says this spirit of cooperation is what makes the Guild so successful at bringing more local food to dinner tables across the area. She stops by the studios today to talk about the Guild's plans for expanding small and medium-sized farmers' business opportunities. Speaking of local food, Abby Fentress Swanson of Harvest Public Media talks about how Walmart is trying to get in on this fast-growing sector of agriculture. And later we talk with Doug Siegel of Vigilant Eats about his organic, gluten-free, non-GMO superfood breakfast cereal. Stay with us. Mia Partlow is here with the Food News headlines.
Hey, Annie. Following years of delays, a class action lawsuit between dairy farmers and their cooperative has been settled out of court. The Dairy Farmers of America, Inc. agreed to pay $158.6 million to farmers in the Southeast, saying it didn't want to risk going to trial. Farmers asserted that the DFA and Dallas-based Dean Foods conspired to eliminate competition in the Southeast and then to drastically reduce the prices they would pay farmers for raw milk. DFA and Dean executives positioned themselves to benefit. As NPR reports, Gary Hanman, DFA's former CEO, was paid $31.6 million during the 7 years he led the co-op. Dean Foods' former CEO, Greg Engels, was paid $156 million. The DFA has agreed to be more transparent in its business practices, especially with reference to price-related information. The settlement has proven disappointing for many farmers who had sought $1.2 billion in damages. This year, corn grown for the purpose of creating sweeteners will likely hit its lowest level since 1997. That's according to a January 15th projection by the USDA. High fructose corn syrup is used to sweeten everything from drinks to ketchup, but the decline seems to be linked to the reduction in the amount of soda Americans are drinking. Soda consumption peaked in 1998 at 54 gallons a person and had plummeted 21% by 2011. But this doesn't spell ruin for high fructose corn syrup producers like Cargill. Lauren Bandy, an ingredients analyst with Euromonitor International, told the Washington Post, quote, "As long as the big brands keep using it, they'll have business," unquote. And you don't need the CDC to tell you it's flu season, and this year is particularly bad. We all know the drill. In order to stay healthy, get plenty of rest, drink fluids, wash your hands, and eat sorbet. That's right, Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams has released Influenza Sorbet with cayenne pepper, ginger, lemon and orange juices, bourbon, and honey. Ginger is used as an anti-inflammatory and for stomach issues. The capsaicin in cayenne helps clear the nasal passages. The lemon and orange juices are commonly consumed for their vitamins and flavor, and the honey coats a sore throat. Influenza Sorbet is based off of a hot drink Chef Jenny Britton Bauer's family made when she was a kid, whiskey and all. Although it won't cure the flu, she says it sure will make you feel better. Read more about these stories on our website, eartheats.org, and join the conversation on our Twitter feed and Facebook page. Check us out. Search for Earth Eats.
Mia Partlow bringing us the food news headlines. Great work. We appreciate the time.
Thanks.
The world's largest retailer is muscling in on one of the fastest-growing segments of American agriculture, local food. Walmart says 11% of the produce sold in its stores nationwide comes from local farms. That's up from 4% 2 years ago. There's no doubt this move has shaken up the food supply chain. But as Abby Fentress Swanson reports for Harvest Public Media, small family farms aren't necessarily seeing the benefits.
Columbia, Missouri's East Side Walmart sits at the junction of Interstate 70 and 63. That makes it easy for Herman Ferris to deliver his produce to the supercenter.
Once I leave here, I'll go pick up their bananas they need tonight, deliver them overnight, and they'll have them first thing in the morning.
Ferris, who looks a little like a clean-cut version of Willie Nelson, isn't a farmer. He's a broker and has been for the past 40 years, meaning he buys produce from auctions and farms for grocery stores. He's been buying for Walmart since they first started carrying produce in the early 90s. Walmart calls him several times a week, and Ferris says he always finds what they're looking for, even if it's yucca root in the dead of winter.
They don't want to say no to anything. They don't want to say, no, we don't have, or no, we can't get. It's just, we do have, or we'll have it here real quick.
And what Walmart wants on those shelves is local fruits and vegetables. During the summer, most everything Ferris delivers to the 20 supercenters on his turf is grown in Missouri. That's Walmart's definition of local, grown and sold in the same state. Back in 2010, Walmart pledged to double its local produce sales and help small farmers grow and become suppliers for Walmart. The chains already surpassed that local foods goal. But, at least in Missouri, there's little evidence of a widespread benefit to small farmers, in part because Walmart's low-cost strategy can be a barrier to doing business with the company. Walmart did not respond to repeated interview requests to be part of this story. However, testifying in front of Congress in March, Walmart's Senior Director of Sustainable Agriculture, Ron McCormick, claimed the emphasis on local has saved customers over $1 billion.
We operate 41 state-of-the-art grocery distribution centers across the country. The advantage here is that many of them are located in potentially productive agricultural areas. We work to source more produce from areas close to these centers, allowing us to cut costs from the supply chain and to sell a more affordable, fresher product to our customers.
But Wyatt Frass of the Center for Rural Affairs says he wants Walmart to break down those cost savings and explain how it's gotten its local sourcing up to 11%. Especially since in most parts of the country, including in the Midwest, it's much more of a challenge to source local produce year-round than it is in, say, California or Florida.
Unfortunately, there's so little definition and transparency about how that happens that we don't really know how it happens or if it happens. It's their own numbers, their own record-keeping, their own definitions.
Frass adds that farms have to be big to satisfy Walmart's needs. In fact, of the 8 farms Walmart highlights on its local foods webpage, 5 of them are very large farms by the U.S. Department of Agriculture standards, with annual sales in the millions of dollars. The University of Missouri Extension's Jennifer Shooter says small-scale farmers in northeast Missouri can't produce enough to sell to Walmart.
The growers here do not have enough quantity to supply the Walmart store, and they only have, you know, produce for about 4 months out of the year, you know, and Walmart wants produce consistently from the same distributor pretty much all year long.
But doing business with Walmart has been working for a handful of operations in the Midwest, like a small grower in Kansas called Divine Gardens, or Missouri Vegetable Farm, which sits on 200 acres 70 miles south of St. Louis.
We're the first and largest Missouri grower here.
Food Safety Director Jason Lander says Missouri Vegetable Farm was created 2 years ago to supply Walmart with produce. The operation is part of Proffer Wholesale Produce, which has been a produce middleman for Walmart since the 1990s. Overall, the company has sales of nearly $60 million a year. Inside the Proffer's 175,000-square-foot packing and shipping facility, Lander says he thinks farms, regardless of their size, have to adapt their business models to compete in the local foods market.
A lot of farmers over the last few generations have seen that there is, you know, this huge growth in production, and with the big push on the locally grown product, they've already trained themselves that if they want to continue to succeed, that they're going to have to modify their operations.
But LaDonna Redmond says it's a slippery slope when farms start changing their business models to work with Walmart.
And that's the question. Will it actually benefit them, or will the situation turn out to be one where the benefit really is transferred to Walmart and not necessarily to the income or improving the income of small family farmers?
Redmond works for the nonprofit Institute of Agriculture and Trade Policy, which advocates for family farms. She says that until Walmart builds the cost of producing local food into its prices, few small farms will truly benefit. Abby Fentress-Swanson, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. Eight years ago, a handful of farmers got together to try to increase the visibility of local food in South Central Indiana and to help each other be more successful. Today, the local Growers Guild has expanded to 80 grower members, everyone from vegetable farmers and meat producers to those producing value-added products like soaps and flours. Megan Hutchison is the LGG's manager and a farmer herself. It's her job to make connections amongst all these folks and to wrangle all the interns and volunteers who make up the majority of the Guild's organizational team. She stopped by the Earth Eats studios to talk about the issues facing small and medium-sized farms in Indiana. It's funny to think that a group that's so visible in the food community in Bloomington has only been around for 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
So take me back 8 years. How did it start?
Bobby Booz and a small handful of growers who saw a need for supporting each other and also growing new farmers. A lot of farmers are at retirement age right now, and so there was a need to sort of share the knowledge that some of the older folks had with the new farmers that were interested in growing.
You know, I chatted with three, I think, interns and guild members a little bit ago. And this concept of collaboration amongst competitors is something that struck me when I spoke with them. And hearing you talk about how the guild started, again, it's competing farms working together to make the community, the food community, stronger.
Well, I guess it's in the nature of cooperatives. And one of the things that's really nice about our guild is it a little bit harkens back to the kind of rural old times where you help your neighbor out. You know, your tractor's broke down. Well, I can borrow your piece of equipment. You know, I've had that happen at my farm before. Oh, I'll call the guy down the road and he helps me out. It's about building relationships, building community. And so while it's competitive, I still think there's a lot of room for new growers.
You know, I was talking about how visible the local Growers Guild is, but a lot of people, even foodies in the community, don't really know what you do. So tell me some specifics about how you bring people together.
Sure. We support our members through direct support, education, and market connections. So with the direct support, that could mean things like our bulk ordering program. So both community members and our members can participate in this where we buy seeds, we buy trees, we buy amendments, and then we get a lower cost for all of our members. And then we do things like promotion. So we put out our local growers guide, which is great for consumers, too, that are looking to find a CSA or, you know, who in the community is selling meat. That is one way. And then we also have education is a huge part of what we do. We do lots of workshops where we'll bring in folks to talk about a certain topic. And then one of my most favorite things about the Guild is our monthly potluck that we do. And we just host it at a member farm. It's a social activity. It's a way for people to touch base in the Guild and then also learn about a certain topic. So we did one 2 months ago on medicinals, and we have one coming up on small hand tools. We also are advocating for small and medium-sized farms. So we look at issues that really affect those constituents.
Before you get away from that, let's actually talk about the issues that are affecting small and medium-sized farmers today.
Oh, gosh.
Where to begin?
We need a whole nother hour. Well, I mean, I think a lot of folks were disappointed in the farm bill. A lot of it stuck with the status quo of what we know of large farms being helped and not a lot of small farms being helped. And actually some organizations and some grants were cut that helped small farmers. So that was a little disappointing. The Local Growers Guild is working on a food hub to try to increase food in our community. But that can only take us so far. We really need to look at who's in control of food policy in the U.S., and it is controlled by a small number of large agricultural companies that have a lot of funding and control how things work and who gets money and who doesn't. We're kind of waiting on the new Farmer Rancher Program grant that funds pretty much farmer schools for new growers. That's kind of up in the air right now. There's also state issues happening. So I don't know if you've heard about all the raw milk issues going on. You know, we have a couple grower members in our guild that have been either on the committee or kind of talking publicly about that issue. And then, you know, locally, of course, they recently improved the chicken poultry ordinance in our city. And folks really want to expand that to ducks and look at fencing and lots of other things. So lots of things going on in the community.
Let's get to the food hub then. Let me see if we can together describe what a food hub is. It sounds as though my understanding of it is that farmers and producers come together under this big umbrella organization, and they sort of combine all of their yields so that consumers like me or restaurants can buy stuff at a lower price in bulk, and that farmers can get their stuff out there to more people. Is that mm-hmm. about right?
Yeah. Food hubs have a lot of – they can look really different depending on sort of the model. There's about, I think, 65 food hubs around the country. There's a couple things happening in northern Indiana with the Chicago area. But right now, Bloomington, Indianapolis, Terre Haute, we're all kind of looking at different food hub models. I think what's going to happen is it's going to be a collaboration of a couple food hubs around the state, and we're all going to work together. And the one we're looking at here is to aggregate products from different farms to then, you know, sell to restaurants, sell to eventually, hopefully, schools, the hospital, and other institutions like IU and down the line. So it's a balancing act of, you know, the growers getting the most bang for their buck, because, of course, if you sell directly to a consumer, you're going to get more money. But if farmers have the opportunity to scale up and distribute produce to restaurants and stores, well, that's great. And that gets more local food into people's kitchens.
So you must be talking to the stores and the restaurants in the area. Mm-hmm. They're on board for this idea?
We work with the Bloomington Independent Restaurant Association, and we've been able to collect some average prices from different restaurants around town to then share that with the growers to see if it's something that will work into their business plan. So we're in the process of kind of developing a model, getting feedback from growers, seeing what will work best, applying for grants. So that's sort of the process we're in right now. And one thing that we really want to talk with other folks across Indiana about is that there is definitely room for the state to get involved in food hubs and to help with the infrastructure costs, the capital expenses. A lot of the food hubs across the country have support from their state governments, and so we really would love it if the state would step in with that. Rural development has been amazing, but there's definitely room for economic development to step in as well.
Megan Hutchison will be back next week to talk about the Local Growers Guild's educational programs, including a new video series that illustrated everything from permaculture and seed saving to butchering a pig. Learn more about the LGG on their website. It's localgrowers.org. Coming up,
the chia seeds actually absorb a lot of water, and then they don't give the water back to your body very easily. So that means it makes you feel full and content for a long period of time.
Chef Daniel Orr is making a nice breakfast dish using one of the it ingredients of the moment, chia seeds. So come back for that. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. You might have seen this little yellow cup popping up at coffee shops and grocery stores over the past year. It's the organic superfood oat-based cereal by the Bloomington-based business Vigilant Eats. Doug Siegel is the chief executive officer and creator of Vigilant Eats. He saw a hole in the market for health-conscious folks needing to eat on the go. So all you have to do is add water to this mixture of oats, goji berries, cacao nibs, and hemp and oat flour. Stir it in, and there you go. It comes with its own spoon and everything. I stopped by Siegel's house to give it a shot myself.
Okay, sure.
So reading the instructions here, it's pretty simple. Three steps. Remove the lid, remove the enclosed spoon. While stirring, slowly add cold water to desired consistency, or milk if you want.
Right, milk. You can even add hot water. Some of the coffee houses have been asking if we can do this as a hot oatmeal. And yeah, there's no problem. Just add hot water.
So sure enough, there's a spoon in there, and the cup is going to serve as a bowl, so you don't have to dirty any dishes.
Correct. And the spoon, it's a folding spoon. So basically, you just take it out of its container here, snap it into place. You could see some goji berries and some cacao nibs. It's just raw chocolate.
And lots of oats.
And lots of oats. And so when you pour the water, what you don't want to do is drown it. It's something where you add a little bit of water at a time, you stir it, and try to get it to a consistency that you like. But what you don't want to do is end up with, you know, a cup filled with water.
All right, here we go. And I'm going to taste it. So I have to get one of the goji berries and the cacao nibs for sure. Big bite. Ooh, that is good. That's hearty, too. You know, the sweetness that I'm tasting, is that brown sugar? Is that what's in there?
No, it's coconut palm sugar, it's maple powder, and it's yacon root, which is a root vegetable.
None of these things I've heard of.
Siegel developed this cereal based on something he used to make for himself. Now he hopes this gluten-free, dairy-free, certified organic, non-GMO, and vegan cereal will challenge what we think health food should be.
This was so obvious to me. You want to help people, give them something that they think is going to taste bad, but then it really tastes good, and they know it's good for them. And this is what changes lives. Telling people that they should eat things that are healthy, well, everybody knows that. If people don't do it, there's a reason, and I think that I'm addressing the reason.
Can I take this with me?
Yeah, please do.
Learn more about Vigilant Eats on their website, vigilanteats.com. Now, in the kitchen, this is a hot cereal that's not really meant to be prepared in a hurry. In fact, Chef Daniel Orr suggests preparing this the night before to streamline your morning routine.
This is steel-cut oats, and they take a lot longer to cook. And a lot of times it will stick to the bottom of the pan. You know, you're there in the morning, and it takes 45 minutes to cook, so you don't have time. So I'm going to show you an easy way. What we do here is I have got a pan on. I'm going to put a little bit of oil in the pan and then add about half a cup of oats, depending on how many people you're cooking for. And what we're going to do is just toast those a little bit. Well, what this does is it brings out kind of a nutty, smoky flavor. And you want them just to get a little bit brown and start to smoke a little bit. And they'll taste much more kind of nutty and smoky. Okay, so we let these toast. We're going to cover them with about an inch of water. All right, we're going to bring that back to the fire, bring that up to a boil. While we're waiting for that to boil, we're going to add some orange zest. And that's going to bring a little more intrigue and mystery to your oats. And once it boils, I'm going to add just a little bit of vanilla. Now, you want it to boil first because if you add this right now, a lot of the flavor will just go up into the air. So we're going to bring that to a boil. I'm going to add just about a teaspoon of vanilla. Give it a good stir. Bring it back to a rolling boil. And then just turn off the heat. And that's all there is to cooking breakfast. All right, so I've got some that I've already done the night before. So to finish this off, I'm going to put just a little bit of brown sugar, and then I've toasted some pecans. You can put just a little more orange zest on top just so you can see that. And you don't need a lot of sugar and stuff when you have those extra flavors of the vanilla and the orange peel in there. They kind of make it an automatically appealing breakfast.
One more breakfast recipe with Chef Orr. The ingredients on the table for this one are soy milk, agave nectar, salt, some fruit, and a bag full of what look like little black pellets.
Those are chia seeds. Cha-cha-cha-chia. Seriously, that's what they are.
Yep, the same stuff that grows hair on those chia pet terracotta planters. Those novelty items might be a thing of the past, but the chia seeds themselves are enjoying new life as one of the latest it foods for the health conscious. They're small, think of sesame seeds, and very expensive, over $10 a pound, but they do pack a nutritional punch, high in omega-3 fatty acids, protein, fiber, and antioxidants. Once they've been soaked overnight, Chef Orr insists they are really tasty.
Can pack in more flavorful punch. I'm a little skeptical about them adding a flavorful punch because it looks like you've soaked it in some soy milk there, and it just sort of looks like a gelatinous glop.
Well, it looks kind of like rice pudding, you know.
So or rice pudding.
You've got to think of it in pleasant terms. The chia seeds actually absorb a lot of water, and then they don't give the water back to your body very easily. So that means it makes you feel full and content for a long period of time. And they are expensive. They cost over $10 a pound, but you don't need a whole lot. So I really suggest people go out and try some new things. It's a lot of fun. Okay, and basically what you do is you take 2/3 cups of the chia seeds, you pour over about 2¼ cup of whatever kind of milk you want. If you want to go vegan, you could do an almond milk, you could do a soy milk, or you could use coconut milk in this too. So that gives you another option. Coconut milk's going to be a little richer, it has that nice fattiness to it. And then you let them sit for 24 hours, overnight at least. 24 hours is even better. And what you come up with is this kind of rice pudding looking mixture. So staying with our kind of a vegan theme, we're going to use the agave to sweeten it. We're going to add just a little touch of lemon juice.
Straight from the lemon. You made a point to slice a lemon open, so you're not using stuff from the jar.
Oh, no, that stuff doesn't taste like lemon to me. And the lemon is going to give it that little acid kick to just give our flavor complexity. You want to hit all those different parts on your tongue. You can add some vanilla extract or almond extract if you like. You can put a little pinch of salt in this too. Then we're just going to dish this out, and what's going to make it look a lot better is the fresh fruit we put on top. So, got a couple bowls here. I'm going to put a few kumquats on here. Again, getting that citrus flavor. A few blueberries and a few blackberries. And then put a little green mint on there. And that's as simple as it is. And give chia pets a chance.
Give chia pets a break.
Yeah, exactly.
See a photo of this dish on the website. We're calling it chia seed breakfast pudding as a nod to the rice pudding-like consistency. We're always eager to hear from folks who try out our recipes. Let us know if you like this one. Our email address is eartheats@gmail.com. In addition to this, there are a whole slew of breakfast dishes on the website. Find inspiration for your next meal at eartheats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for tuning in today. Till next week, happy eating. I'm Annie Corrigan.